My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
Frequency Podcast Network. Stories that matter, podcasts that resonate.
You recognize the artwork we're going to discuss today. Or at least, you recognize the broad style. It's unmistakable. You've seen it many times before. What is interesting, though, is even if you know this art and this artist intimately, even if you love it and appreciate it, even if you own some of it, you might not know what's authentic and what's not. Indigenous art fraud is an epidemic, and we've reported on that before. But even in that world, the Norval Morisseau case is a massive one. The sheer scale of the fakes alone is one thing, but it's the process that led to the creation of these fakes, the crimes committed behind that process, and the ongoing attempt to sort this whole mess out that makes this much more than a story about art fraud. Though that is where we begin. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Luke Rinaldi is an award-winning writer who's based in Toronto. He's written for Maclean's, Toronto Life, Canadian Business, and many more, including this piece for The Walrus. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Your story is, as I mentioned, so fascinating. Start by telling us, so that we all are starting from the same place, who was Norval Morisseau?
Norval Morisseau was one of Canada's greatest artists. He was also, I think, one of the most famous Indigenous artists pretty much anywhere in the world. He was born in the 1930s near Thunder Bay, and like a lot of Indigenous kids back then, he was sent to residential school where, you know, he was abused physically, verbally, sexually, and art was really a respite for him. And he really dove into it as soon as he was out of school. It was around the time he was 30 that he had his first solo show in Toronto, and that really launched his career. And from there, he had shows in the US and in Europe, and he helped create a group called the Indigenous Group of Seven, and he became widely known as the Picasso of the North.
Describe his art for us, if you can, first, because I know there's so much of it, but also because the style of it, which I think almost everyone listening has seen, is so unique.
You're right. It's called the Woodland School, and it's basically based on Morisseau's work. There's a lot of people who paint in his style now, but he was the first one to do it. And like you said, you know, he used a lot of different materials, a lot of different media. You know, in my research, I found that he used not just paint, but crayons and blood, apparently, as his material. And he painted on fridge doors and pizza boxes. But eventually he, you know, got to a point where he was mostly just painting with paints on standard canvases. And the way I would describe his work is, you know, you've got these very bold black lines, you've got very vibrant colors, color blocked out, and you've got usually some combination of bears and birds and different beasts. And these are all from sort of Ojibwe legends that his grandfather had told him about. But then he also introduces Catholic iconography or Christian iconography like Jesus. And then, you know, on the next canvas, he'll be painting a penis. And so it's really all over the place. Once you get familiar with sort of his oeuvre, you can sense where he's coming from and what he's doing. But you're right, it is a whole lot of things that he created, thousands and thousands of works, and they're quite unique.
You told us a little bit about his background. He lived a unique adult life as well. Tell us about that before we get into the mystery kind of at the heart of this thing.
Yeah, he was an itinerant guy. He moved around a lot. He was in different towns and cities across Canada throughout his life. And he lived with friends. He lived with his agents. He lived with random people in hotels, occasionally lived on the street. And even though he made good money selling his paintings, you know, as of his 30s, he really, you know, spent his money pretty carelessly. After his first show in Toronto, that really successful one I was mentioning, he hired a taxi to bring him home, which was like 14 hours. So I don't know what taxis went for back then, but that would have been expensive. And, you know, he also spent a lot of money on booze. And this is sort of not a secret. He struggled with substance abuse. And he spent a fair bit of his life trying to, you know, get his drinking under control. And at a certain point, he did. But he really relied on his friends and his agents and apprentices to sort of help him manage his career and his finances. And some of those people really took advantage of him and his talent. And I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, let's start with what happened in the summer of 2006, which is maybe a good place to pick it up. And there was supposed to be an auction that kind of serves as one of the hooks of this story. What happened there?
That's right. There was an auction. It was a reputable auction house called Heffel in Toronto, and they had a number of Morisseaus up for auction. And Morisseau's business manager, a guy named Gabe Vadas, he looked at the auction and realized that a number of the Morisseaus that were up for auction, at least to his mind, were fake.
Huh.
They were not painted by Morisseau, but forged by someone else and signed off as if they were created by Norval. The fact that there were fakes was not surprising or new to them. There were, you know, fakes around, and a lot of great artists deal with fakes. That's just what happens in the art world. And Morisseau had seen some of them before. But in this case, why this particular auction ends up being a huge moment in the story of Morisseau and the fakes, it's that Heffel ended up removing these fakes from the auction, and that set off this very long, complex chain of events, which starts with the owner of those paintings suing Vadas, the guy who identified them as fakes, and the owner says, my paintings are real, you said they were fake, Heffel removed them from auction, and therefore you devalued my paintings, so you should give me some money. And Morisseau wanted to go to Toronto himself and tell the judge, hey, I didn't paint these things. But before the trial arrived, he fell ill and he died. And it's now almost 20 years later, and we're still talking about these fakes.
What do we know about not just these fakes, but all the Morisseau fakes out there? How many are there and who makes them and where do they come from?
Yeah, we know there's at least about 1,000 because the police have seized at least 1,000. But the estate, the Morisseau estate, estimates that there are thousands more. We know from police information that there were three sort of interrelated forgery rings. And we have more details on one than the others. It seems like the folks who were involved all sort of worked together or at least overlapped in some ways. Some of these fakes are really easy to spot because they're signed differently from typical Morisseau pieces and the line work is pretty sloppy. But others are quite tricky because they look real. And it's only once you're familiar with Morisseau's process and his method that you can separate the counterfeits from the real thing. And it often takes an expert to know for sure. And the Morisseau estate is actually in the process of developing an AI tool that can help separate real paintings from fakes.
You mentioned that just before his death, Morisseau had gone to Toronto and wanted to tell the judge, like, these are not my paintings. That was later in his life. In general, how did he feel about fakes and forgeries and the people making them?
Well, at first, he actually sort of turned a blind eye. He knew that people were making fakes, and these people were sort of friends, relatives, apprentices. These were people who were close to him, and this was, you know, the 1980s, the 1990s. And he realized, okay, these people are painting stuff that's a similar style to mine. They can sell it off under their own name and make pennies, or, you know, they just sign my name and they'll make a whole lot more money. They can pay their rent. They can buy groceries, they can live a good life. And so a friend of Morisseau's, a guy named Bryant Ross, who helped out with his business affairs, told me that Morisseau sort of looked the other way and let it happen because he was a generous guy and he wanted the people around him to do well.
When and how did that really start to change? And I guess where?
This all starts to change in the 1990s. That's when Morisseau's in Thunder Bay, he meets a guy named Gary Lamont. And Gary Lamont is a drug dealer known around Thunder Bay as a bit of a tough guy. And he and Morisseau work out this deal. Morisseau provides Gary Lamont with a few paintings. And Lamont says, okay, in exchange, you can go paint at this cabin I have on a lake near Thunder Bay. And so Lamont realizes just how much money he can get selling these paintings. And it seems like he hatches a plan around this time to, unbeknownst to Morisot, at least as far as I know, Lamont wants to create and sell a bunch of counterfeits. And the really ugly thing about this plan was that Lamont didn't make the fakes himself and just sell them off. He actually got other indigenous artists, including some of Morisot's relatives and his friends and former apprentices. And he paid them in cash. He paid them in drugs. He paid them in booze. He used their status cards to buy art materials without paying tax. And then they would sell off those paintings to gallerists and auctioneers. And the truly awful part was that Lamont was also billeting some of these young men in his house. And a number of these young men would later tell the courts that Lamont raped them. And I can say all of this with some certainty because Lamont has pleaded guilty to both sexual assault and to running this forgery ring.
How did Lamont end up in court to plead guilty to that forgery ring and the sex assault? And I know this sounds like a very strange adjacent question, but how did the bare naked ladies find their way into this story?
Yeah, the story takes a lot of twists and turns, but I don't think anyone saw the bare naked ladies factoring in. It really goes back to 2010. The Art Gallery of Ontario asked Kevin Hearn, a member of the Bare Naked Ladies, to show some of his private art collection at the gallery. And so he's a fan of Morisot. And I talked to him and he told me, you know, he included a supposed Morisot, a piece called Spirit Energy of Mother Earth, in this show. But what happened was within a few days, the gallery took it down and they called him and they said, I think this painting might be fake. And so Hearn was surprised and he tried to figure out what was going on. But he went to the gallerist that he bought it from and that guy was not cooperating. He refused to believe it was a fake. And so Hearn decided to hire a lawyer, a guy named Jonathan Summer, who had been involved with Morisot fakes and trying to bring them to light before. And so they started working together and investigating where these paintings came from. It's a long, fascinating, and heartbreaking saga. And if anyone wants the full story, I highly recommend they watch Jamie Kastner's excellent documentary called There Are No Fakes, which really gets into it. And ultimately, it was the creation of that film that caught the attention of police. And then they began investigating the forgery of Morisot's works. And that's what led to the arrest of 8 people last year.
How did they go from that investigation to the arrest? And what did they learn sort of along that way about the scale of the forgeries that Lamont was creating out of that cabin and that workspace?
It certainly took them a while to figure it all out because it was such a complex operation. They discovered some of the details that I told you about this cabin. They spoke to some of the young men who worked there, in addition to indigenous artists that Lamont had hired and told, hey, I'll pay you if you make these kinds of paintings, but just don't sign them. Ultimately, you know, there were more than 1,000 fakes. Lamont and some of the people he was working with would drive out to Alberta and in British Columbia and sell these by the dozens and then come back home and make some more. And so it was huge when the police announced the arrests. They called it the biggest art fraud in world history.
What kind of effects did it have on the Indigenous art community in Canada or just Canada's art community in general? How big a deal was this?
This was huge in part because it had been such a long time coming. People knew there were fake Morisots going around, but because no one had proven it in a legal sense, you couldn't really even say that there were fake Morisots or else you ran the risk of getting sued for devaluing someone's paintings. And so when Lamont pleaded guilty, and in fact, when Kevin Hearn won an appeal that said that the provenance of one of his pieces was fabricated, it sort of lent some closure to this. It didn't solve the problem because there are still so many fakes out there, but it did make certain that there are fakes, and we know there are. And now the estate and police are sort of on board and working on it and trying to legitimize this market again. But as I learned, the art world in general, and particularly the Indigenous art world, this story is not an exception. This is symbolic of a problem that runs much deeper.
Why does that problem run so deep in the Indigenous community in the first place? And, you know, how widespread is it in this country?
So Indigenous artwork is being counterfeited and faked en masse. The reality is that Canada prizes, or at least likes to say that it prizes, its Indigenous art. It celebrates the artists. But the unfortunate reality is that when people go out to actually buy these pieces of art, they're often looking at counterfeits. So if you go online and you think you're buying a piece from, you know, an artist from BC, it's a beautiful carving, it may be a 3D printed counterfeit that was produced in Eastern Europe. And so I talked to a number of Indigenous artists who just told me straight up, we deal with this stuff every day.
Right.
They go online, they see their designs printed on mugs and t-shirts and Crocs, and they report the sellers, they try to shut down these websites, and it works for like 24 hours, and then a new site pops up, and suddenly their wares are available again. And it's such a deep-seated and hard-to-tackle problem that a lot of these artists have sort of just given up on fighting them because they can't spend millions of dollars to hire lawyers to investigate what's happening, to go, you know, across the ocean to where many of these things are being manufactured. And the ultimate effect is that it takes a real toll on their livelihood because buyers can get art that they want cheaper, albeit of lower quality. And so it's hard for a real Indigenous artist, you know, to make a living as an artist. And that discourages young people from becoming artists themselves. And so in my Walrus piece, I talk about some of the legislative changes, some of the policing changes that could really help address this problem. But so far, nothing's really happening. And so Indigenous artists are just being left high and dry.
Give us a quick sense of what could help in terms of legislative or policing changes.
Yeah, I talked to a senator, or I should say a retired senator now named Patricia Bovey, who has sort of led the charge on these legislative changes. And a few things include better controls at the border. So training customs guards to identify fakes, to know where they're coming from, to better intercept them. Another thing that would help is, you know, for real artists who are selling authentic works, finding a way to recompense them after the fact. So say they sell an artwork to a buyer, they make whatever money they make. If that buyer then puts it up for auction or they sell it to someone else, the original artist doesn't get any new money, even though their artwork is earning someone else possibly more than they sold it for. And so Bovey recommended doing what some other countries have done, which is introducing resale rights, which would give something like 5% of the sale price or the resale price of an artwork back to the original artist. And, you know, there are some complicated factors of how you achieve these kinds of things, but other countries have done them. They're doable, they work, they're very helpful. And in fact, I believe the Canadian government has said, we will do this. And they've already passed their timeline for, I think, when they plan to do it. So in my opinion, it can't happen too soon.
You mentioned they've already found 1,000 plus Morisot fakes. They suspect there are more out there, but also, as you also mentioned, his own volume of original work was so huge. How does somebody interested in perhaps acquiring a Morisot, or even somebody who thinks and hopes they have a Morisot, authenticate it? I know you mentioned an AI program. Is that available now? Like, what do we do with his artwork today?
Yeah, this is a very complicated question because it gets to the heart of the problem. There are so many people involved with this story who claim to be the good guys. And so it can be hard to know who to trust, who can actually authenticate paintings, and who's just sort of trying to make a buck. The short answer is that there are some credible people. You know, the lawyer who worked with Kevin Hearn, Jonathan Summer, is involved in some authentication work. There are other folks out there. I think if you read my piece in The Walrus or you watch There Are No Fakes, you'll get a sense of what can give away a fake. There are these black dry brush signatures on the back of some pieces, and that's sort of a giveaway. There are certain types of lines and certain types of forms that are not really Morisot's thing, but show up a lot in the fakes. Ultimately, it's not easy. It takes an expert opinion, and even the courts didn't agree with some of the experts who came and said these are fakes. So my unfortunate answer for a lot of those people is you've got to do your research. You've got to figure out who you can trust. And you might have to pay a little bit of money just to figure out whether the Morisot that you have or would like to buy is the genuine article.
Luke, thanks for this. As I said, such a fascinating story and sums up the problems so many Canadian artists, including Indigenous artists, are grappling with.
You're right. Thanks, Jordan.
Luke Rinaldi, writing for The Walrus. That was The Big Story. And for more from us, including the previous episode I mentioned off the top about Indigenous art fraud, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can, as always, give us some feedback by emailing us at hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca or by calling us and leaving a voicemail at 416-935-5935. The Big Story is available wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's in every single smart speaker. Just ask them to play The Big Story podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.